From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Emerging artists for the first couple hours of bumper music tonight. Their website, of course, all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Later tonight, Atheists and Believers. It's called God Faith. Looking forward to that. Just back from Contact in the Desert in Indian Wells, California. Tom and I had a great time out there, and I got to tell you, our Coast to Coast listeners are by far the best listeners for talk radio around the world. So informative and attentive. Had a great time. Here's what's happening. The Virginia Beach shooter, who killed 12 people and wounded several others in a municipal complex on Friday, apparently had submitted his resignation earlier that morning. The gunman, identified as 40-year-old Dwayne Craddock, was an engineer with the city's public utilities department for 15 years. In a news conference Sunday morning, the Virginia Beach city manager, Dave Hansen, described the man's work performance as satisfactory, with no ongoing issues of discipline at all. Go figure. Google is experiencing high levels of congestion in eastern United States today, and it has affected multiple services in Google Cloud, G Suite, and YouTube. So if you've had trouble getting into those, that's why. Amazon could face heightened antitrust security under a new agreement between U.S. regulators that puts it much closer watch by the Federal Trade Commission. The move is the result of the FTC and the Department of Justice, the U.S. government's leading antitrust enforcement agencies, quietly divvying up competition oversight of two of the country's top tech companies, the other, of course, being Google. They are watching them closely. Israel carried out airstrikes in Syria on Sunday in response to rare rocket fire from its neighboring country, according to its military, with a war monitor reporting that 10 soldiers from Syria were killed and some other foreign fighters. Hezbollah's chief is warning that a war in the Gulf against Iran could engulf the region. Meanwhile, just weeks after Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced a renewed pressure campaign targeting Iran's energy sector, America's top diplomat said the Trump administration is willing to talk with Iran with no preconditions, but he added that the sanctions that have crippled Iran's economy will remain in effect. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia continues having issues with Iran. Could there be a talk of war? Let's check in with Dr. Jerome Corsi, author of Atomic Iran. Jerry, what do you think of the prospects of Saudi Arabia going to war with Iran?
I think they're increasing, George, because Saudi Arabia right now is trying to put together a coalition of Gulf states to oppose Iran. And really, the ultimate conflict in the whole Gulf region is between the Shiites in Iran and the Sunnis in Saudi Arabia. As badly as Iran hates Israel, they hate Saudi Arabia just about as bad.
Can Saudi Arabia beat Iran without U.S. help?
Probably not, George. I think that's really the key issue. And right now, the Trump administration is trying to go the route of sanctions to really economically punish Iran for, again, engaging in nuclear weapons. And Iran has ramped up its nuclear program once again, with centrifuges producing highly enriched uranium. Now that the agreement that Secretary Kerry had negotiated under the Obama administration has been canceled by the Trump administration. Tensions in the region, I think, George, are at this point increasing.
They're at the highest level they've been in a long time, Jerry.
Yes, that's correct. And the likelihood of a war or an incident provoking a war right now is as high as it's been in years.
Keep in touch with us, Dr. Jerome Corsi. If North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un has executed a top official over his handling of nuclear talks in Hanoi, the U.S. top North Korean diplomat says he has not gotten word. Let's check in with Charles R. Smith, our expert on such matters. Charles, what do you think about this situation? Did Kim really kill this guy?
Apparently not, because he has already appeared in the press.
So they say.
Yeah, well, he may have been kind of demoted because he was ranked 10th out of 12 appearing at a recent conference, but for all practical purposes, maybe lost a little bit of shine. But at this point, he's still alive. He's still breathing. It doesn't appear to have any holes in him.
What do you think is going to happen between North Korea and us? I mean, tensions are still there. What's going to happen?
More of the same. We'll have a couple of tit-tats. We've seen them shoot a couple of very short-range ballistic missiles. We've engaged in some conversations with the South Koreans about purchasing more F-35s. They're already taking possession of some. So just expect to see, like I said, more of the same. You know, we're going to see Kim looking to get a check out of this, and,
yep,
and our guys looking to get assurances he's not going to do anything crazy.
Charles' website, softwar.net. Drivers in the lone state of Texas are about to be seeing less red. The Texas governor, Greg Abbott, has announced that he has signed legislation that bans red light cameras across the state. The House Bill 1361 there, authored by a Republican state representative, would prohibit the use of photographic traffic signal enforcement systems. At least seven states are trying to ban them altogether. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, with us here. I'm sure a lot of drivers wouldn't mind banning these red light cameras, John.
Well, there's no question about it. I mean, you go to places like Culver City, and you see the city is wired like almost like every couple blocks there seems like a red light camera. It's like one of the most dangerous places to drive, I think, in the United States right now. But I think, you know, when you consider the fact that Los Angeles had the wisdom, I think the city council banned them in 2011. It went into effect in 2012. So that's a long time ago. And L.A., as you know, is one of the largest municipalities in the country, certainly with the most automobiles. I think it's a violation of due process for most people. The revenue that is brought into the state is unquestionably almost obscene amount of revenue. I don't know if you know this, but a red light ticket in California right now costs an average of $490.
Jeez, just one ticket?
For one ticket. And, you know, they tack on all these additional fees. It's like, you know, buying a gallon of gas in California. I mean, everything is like taxed to death. We have such a, you know, the legislature never met a tax it didn't like. In fact, there's a new one coming on Tuesday. I hope people are paying attention to that, where the school board is asking to take, if you can believe this, $160 out of every 1,000 square feet you own in a home. And there's some people that own a lot of square footage. There's some homes near where I live where they have 50 and 60,000 square foot homes. That would amount to a lot of property tax. But I think it's another government overreach, you know, these red light cameras. And it's high time, you know, they get rid of them, because I think they really do violate the 14th Amendment for most people.
Well, one of the problems, too, has always been the driver saying, I wasn't in the car, I lent it out.
They do that, and they also rig the yellow light timing sequence.
That's right.
That the green goes to red almost immediately, and so you're stuck.
You're stuck there. You're caught on camera.
Absolutely.
All right, John, thank you. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. A Spanish YouTube star who pranked a homeless man by filling an Oreo cookie with toothpaste was sentenced to 15 months in prison and owes the victim $22,300. What's wrong with people? Bitcoin has a lingering problem that few people are talking about amid the renewed exuberance of the price surge this year that has more than doubled its value. Hardly anyone is using the world's largest cryptocurrency for anything beyond speculation, they say. What else is going on in the crypto world? In a moment, Ben Mizrich joins us in a moment. His latest book, Bitcoin Billionaires, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, and Ben Mizrich is back with us. Ben has created his own genre of nonfiction, chronicling the amazing stories of young geniuses making tons of money on the edge of impossibility, ethics, morality as well. A writing career spanning 20-plus years, Ben has authored several books, including the very successful Bringing Down the House, the inside story of six MIT students who took Vegas for millions. That was turned into a movie, by the way. And The Accidental Billionaires, the founding of Facebook, and so many more. Tonight, Bitcoin Billionaires. Ben, welcome back. Looking forward to always chatting with you.
Well, thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
That was the movie 21, wasn't it, that
yes,
that book was based
on? Yeah, it was 21, about the kids beating Vegas. I think it was 2006. seven or nine.
True story, wasn't it?
True story about a group of college kids who figured out a way to beat Vegas, and they won $6 million playing blackjack. That's a crazy story, yeah.
But they got tossed, too, didn't they?
Well, I mean, even though what they're doing wasn't illegal, the casinos don't like you to do it. And so they were chased out of town and ended up, some of them getting beaten up, things like that. But, yeah, they eventually had to stop.
Bitcoin billionaires. Tell me about that.
So Bitcoin billionaires is, it's the true story of the Winklevoss twins. We remember them from The Social Network. And they are now worth billions and billions of dollars in Bitcoin. And so it kind of follows the rise of Bitcoin. It tells the story of the origins of Bitcoin through these two identical twins who are now two incredibly wealthy people and sort of still caught in this battle with Mark Zuckerberg, who they say stole Facebook from them. So it's this kind of wild drama, kind of a sequel to The Social Network.
They got $65 million in some kind of settlement with Zuckerberg,
didn't
they? Yeah,
they settled for $65 million, but they took it all in stock. So it ended up being worth $500 million after the IPO.
My God.
So that's where the book starts. But what's crazy is, they couldn't do anything with that money. They tried to go out to Silicon Valley and become VCs and invest in companies, and no one would take their money because everyone's end game in Silicon Valley is to sell your company to Mark Zuckerberg. And since Mark Zuckerberg hates those guys so much, they couldn't become investors. So instead, they fell into Bitcoin.
The movie Social Networking did not really shine the Winklevoss twins as very favorable, did it?
Right. So when I wrote that book, you know, to me and to a lot of people, the Winklevoss twins were just these big, you know, alpha male jocks. They represented the establishment. They were the bad guys in the story.
Yeah.
And so the movie itself and afterwards, they were kind of ridiculed. They were made fun of, and they were seen kind of as this one-note caricatures. But the reality is something much different. And so part of the reason, you know, I wrote Bitcoin Billionaires to readdress who the Winklevoss twins are. I learned a lot more about them and realized I had really gotten them wrong.
Were they the ones in the movie who went to the Harvard board and the president of Harvard University and complained?
Yeah, there's that great scene where they're talking to Larry Summers, and Larry Summers basically throws them out of the office. He says, you know, two guys who walk in suits, who wear suits to classes, are always going to be kind of, you know, the wrong guys. And, yeah, so there's that famous scene where they went to Larry Summers and they basically asked him to kick Mark Zuckerberg out of school because Mark had stolen their idea. And instead, they were just sort of laughed out of the room.
Do they get along with Zuckerberg at all anymore?
Oh, no. There's this, you know, both they dislike Zuckerberg and Zuckerberg dislikes them. There's this kind of, what drives them pretty much every day is their hatred of Mark Zuckerberg. They believe that he's, you know, evil, that he stole from them, and they'll never let that go.
Their initial idea was called Connect You, right?
Right. They had a website called Connect You, which was a kind of a dating website. It was a social website.
Was it for Harvard?
It was for Harvard students. You had to have a harvard.edu email to go on it. And they were looking for someone to help them write the programming. And that's when they hired Mark Zuckerberg, who was a year below them in college. So Mark ended up working for them during college, but Mark really didn't have an interest in them or their ideas. He liked hanging out with the cool kids on campus. So he was hanging out with them, pretended to help them, but instead actually launched Facebook without telling them. They claim that some of their ideas from HarvardConnection.com, including the fact that you had to have a harvard.edu email, because when Facebook first launched, you had to have a Harvard email to join it. And so it was very exclusive. And then it moved from college to college. And you had to have a college email, mm-hmm. and then you needed a high school email. And so the twins came up with that idea. And the other idea the twins came up with, there were these circles of friends. So first you had your family group, then your friends group, then your colleagues group. And it was these social circles that initially fed into Facebook, and that's how it worked in the beginning. So those were two ideas that did come from them. But Mark kind of, you know, the worst things that Mark did was he led them on. He pretended to work for them. And all these instant messages came out later, and they're all in my book, Bitcoin Billionaires, where basically he was doing this on purpose. He was leading them on and then launched Facebook without telling them to try and catch them unaware, and then Facebook kind of exploded.
Did Zuckerberg even think Facebook would be as big as it is today?
Well, I mean, I can't imagine anybody thought it would be, you know, the monster it is today.
Because it followed MySpace, right?
Yeah, it was MySpace and Friendster. If you remember that, they were both around, but neither one of them, you know, had anywhere near the reach.
Right.
But when he launched Facebook, he definitely wanted to to dominate the world. I mean, if you read his instant messages, he does talk about dominating. It wasn't really about making money. It was really about creating this kind of social online world where guys like Mark Zuckerberg did well. Because he wasn't a social guy. He wasn't good at, you know, talking to girls. He wasn't a socialite. And I do think he thought it would catch on, but nobody could have imagined it would be as big as it is today.
No, I bet they didn't. And once it popped in a big way. And Zuckerberg must have felt that he owed the twins something, because he did give them $65 million in stock, as you say.
Well, I mean, he fought and fought and fought. And this settlement went on for years. I mean, the mediation. So this suit happened, and they kept going back and forth forever. So I don't know that Zuckerberg would have, you know, willingly given them anything.
Maybe his partners wanted these other guys out, huh?
Yeah, and the thing is, Mark's, you know, they're not the only people that sued Mark Zuckerberg. And the movie The Social Network was about Eduardo, which was another person who was Mark's friend who helped found Facebook, who Mark had said would get 30% of the company, who then had to go and sue for whatever it is he got. So, you know, Mark has a tendency of sort of just moving on and forgetting the guys who were there with him before.
So once the twins got out, they eventually dabbled with other things. And then how did they end up with Bitcoin?
Well, you know, they were in Silicon Valley. Nobody wanted their money. And they were kind of despondent about it. So they actually went to Ibiza. So they were on the beach in Ibiza partying. And somebody walked up to them and said, "Have you guys heard about this thing called Bitcoin?" And this was 2012, 2011. Bitcoin had started, and it was moving, but it wasn't anything like, you know, what we've all heard of today. It was still in the dollars, you know, $5 a Bitcoin, $7 a Bitcoin. And they didn't know anything about it, and they looked into it, and they thought, you know, either this is a joke or this is the next big thing. And they did some research and decided to dive headlong into it. So it was really a chance meeting on a beach in Ibiza.
How much did they invest initially in this?
Well, they ended up buying 1% of all Bitcoin. So they bought...
So everything that's out there, they owned 1% of it.
200,000 Bitcoin. And they bought it at around between $5 and $7 a coin. So they ended up buying between $11 to $14 million worth of Bitcoin at the time. And, you know... It was a big investment, but compared to how much money they had, it wasn't a huge investment.
They could lose the whole thing, and they wouldn't even have known it, basically.
Right, it wouldn't have killed them or anything like that. Yeah. They also made an investment in one of these early Bitcoin companies, which is, you know, part of the story. It was a company called BitInstant, which was founded by this 19-year-old kid who was living in his mother's basement in Brooklyn, in New York.
Well, he got nailed for fraud, didn't he?
He ended up going to jail. He was one of the first people to go to jail for Bitcoin. His name was Charlie Schrem, brilliant young kid, who, you know, fell into Bitcoin on the Internet. Most of the people who got into Bitcoin early were kind of hackers, libertarians, people who were buying drugs online from a place called Silk Road, which was this online underground website, which, you know, at the time was the only place you could use Bitcoin and was only took Bitcoin. So that was where a lot of initial people. And Charlie created a company that helped people buy Bitcoin. Unfortunately, some of those people used that Bitcoin to buy drugs, and when the federal government shut down Silk Road, they caught some of these guys and traced it back to Charlie.
I am not into Bitcoin, Ben, at all. I just think it's so risky. I keep seeing it going up and up and up, but I'm going to have you, after the break, explain to us just what Bitcoin is all about and where you think it's headed. But so are the brothers still in Bitcoin?
Oh, they're multi-billionaires in Bitcoin. They still own the majority of their 200,000 coins. So, yeah, they're in full, and they run an exchange now called Gemini, which is a big, basically a stock exchange for cryptocurrency. So they're in fully. This is what they do now.
And they're 37 years old apiece.
They're 37-year-old identical twin ex-Olympic rowers who are both worth billions of dollars. Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
It's spectacular. When you see them, it's like something out of Greek mythology. I mean, they don't look like normal people.
Is there a movie behind Bitcoin Billionaires?
Yeah, we're going to do a big movie with Bitcoin Billionaires. We're going to go back to Armie Hammer, hopefully, who played them in the movie The Social Network. So the goal is to do it, you know, over the next year, yeah.
Oh, that would be exciting.
It would be unbelievable. And it's a really crazy story, not just about how Bitcoin happened, but also about what really happened at the end of the Facebook story. So it's a lot of really interesting stuff.
All right. Well, stay with us, Ben. We're going to come back in a moment. We'll talk about Bitcoin, how it was created from this secret individual who's out there somewhere that people keep guessing who he may be. And then we'll get into some other stuff. And we are back with Ben Mezrich. We are going to be taking phone calls with Ben next hour. His latest book is called Bitcoin Billionaires, A True Story of Genius, Betrayal, and Redemption. Ben, explain what Bitcoin is, first of all, for everybody.
Okay. You know, and there's a simple way to explain it, I think, and that's just that it's digital money that is peer-to-peer, meaning I can send you a Bitcoin directly, like an email or a text, with nobody in between us. So rather than going through Visa or a bank, rather than using Western Union or something like that, I can instantly send money, essentially, anywhere in the world, just the same way you send an email. And that's the basic, simple, most simple way of understanding Bitcoin. It's money turned right into, you know, computer language. It's money for the internet. It's the idea of digital money, although it sounds kind of, you know, strange for people who are used to using cash, it's something we already do. Most of your money is already digital. You know, the only actual cash you have is what's in your wallet.
That's right.
When you go to the bank and you make a deposit, they're not keeping some big vault full of your cash. It instantly becomes ones and zeros, and that's how it moves around. It moves around on the internet. So Bitcoin is actually money that moves instantly from you to someone else. And the way that transaction is verified, you know, when I send you one Bitcoin, that's where it gets a little more complex. It's verified by all the different people involved in the Bitcoin community who are running software that essentially does these mathematical problems that prove that transaction happened, and then place it on something called the blockchain, which is this public record, so that it can be seen by everyone, so that everyone knows this transaction happened. But at the same time, me and you and our Bitcoin is kept private. It's our own thing. And you own Bitcoin even though you don't actually physically have anything by getting this address, which, you know, corresponds to your Bitcoin.
Who created this, Ben?
It was created by someone who nobody really knows who he is. In 2008, and the end of that, and then the beginning of 2009, somebody appeared on the internet calling himself Satoshi Nakamoto. Now, this may be one person, this may be multiple people. We're pretty sure his name isn't really Satoshi Nakamoto. He's probably not Japanese. Nobody knows who this person is. And he wrote something called a white paper, which described what Bitcoin was. He posted it on an internet board, and then Bitcoin was launched. And then he vanished. He kind of disappeared, never to be heard from again. Nobody knows who this person is.
To this day, he's gone, right?
He's never come back.
He could be dead.
Supposedly, he has 1 million Bitcoin.
Himself.
Himself. So whoever this person is, he's one of the wealthiest people in the world. But he's never come forward. There's been people who've come forward and said they were him, but most people think they weren't him. There's been people who've made guesses at who he is. And in my book, there's a scene where all these kind of people who were involved in Bitcoin from the very beginning go to this underground party in San Francisco, in San Jose actually, called the Genesis Block Party. And they get this cryptic invitation to show up in this room. And the odds are good that he was someone in that room. But nobody knows, and you can go through that chapter and look at all the different names and try and figure out who it might be, but nobody knows. He's never come forward, which is fascinating, you know, and they've searched for him. At one point, they found this Japanese guy with the name Satoshi Nakamoto. All these reporters camped outside his house and said, this must be him. And he came forward and said, I don't even know what Bitcoin is. it wasn't him. And so it's a wild part of the story is, you know, someone creates something that, you know, many, many people have become billionaires off of this. And he himself is worth many billions of dollars. And yet nobody knows who this person is.
You know, with banks, you know, your checking account and your savings account, they're insured up to $250,000. You know, if the bank goes under, you're protected by the FDIC. What about with Bitcoin? My gosh, if something happens.
It's a different phenomenon. So what's interesting about Bitcoin, in a lot of ways, it's safer because it isn't in the bank. You have it. So you get this, you know, many-digit hash number, and that represents your Bitcoin. And that essentially is your Bitcoin. So it's like carrying around a vault of gold anywhere you bring that number.
Well, who backs it up, though? Who gives it?
Nobody
who props
it up?
It up?
But it exists mathematically. So it's backed by math. So it's unbreakable and unhackable, your Bitcoin. But at the same time, it, of course, can get stolen. So you write it down on a piece of paper, someone steals that piece of paper, they own your Bitcoin, and there's no one to back
it up. Can they hack into it?
If it's kept online, so if you keep your Bitcoin in an electronic wallet that is online, someone could hack your wallet.
And take
but
it.
If you keep it offline, for instance, the way the Winklevoss twins keep their money is really fascinating. So they take these numbers and they print them up on pieces of paper. They cut the paper into little strips, and then they filled a backpack with the paper and went across the United States, going to small banks in the Midwest. And they actually keep their little strips of paper in safety deposit boxes all across the Midwest United States. So the only way you could actually steal their Bitcoin is to go to all these different safety deposit boxes in the right order, put their hash back together, and then steal their Bitcoin. So they keep it very, very safe that way. Some people actually embed it on the on a ring. One of the characters in the book actually has a ring with his Bitcoin number embedded on the inside of the ring, so he carries it around wearing it on his finger. But yes, you know, if someone steals your computer and you have your Bitcoin on your computer, you've lost your Bitcoin. So it's like carrying around all of this gold with you, or, you know, on your phone, which is both scary, but it's also, in a weird way, safer than having it in a bank, because if a bank gets shut down, if there's a run on a bank, or if the government decides tomorrow to take your money out of the bank, there's nothing you can do. The reason Bitcoin actually exploded in the first place is the country of Cyprus in Europe, which is this island.
Oh, they had a mess there with their money system.
Yeah, they went bankrupt. The country went bankrupt, and one night the government decided to solve their problem by just going to everyone's bank account and taking 50% of your money. They just took it, and it turns out they can do that. A government that insures a bank can also take money from that bank if it needs to in a state of emergency. And so Cyprus, one night, everyone's bank accounts were just drained by the government to pay off their debt.
Jeez.
And there was nothing anybody could do. And this was, you know, all these people who were there who had their money realized, I need a form of currency that isn't backed specifically by my country. And this has happened in Venezuela as well, with the money becoming worthless. If you had your money in Venezuelan money over the last year, you lost all your money. But if you had it in Bitcoin, you know, it couldn't be touched by that particular government. It's a universal currency that has nothing, no authority over it. So in a lot of ways, it seems scarier because it seems like there's no government backing it. But, you know, having a government back your money is only as strong as your government. If your government's doing great, then, you know, it's great having your government back your money. But if your government falls apart, so in China, all these Chinese billionaires are moving their money into Bitcoin.
Are they really?
Absolutely. And Russian oligarchs are big into Bitcoin because they're afraid that tomorrow Putin takes their money. So they keep their money in a way, in a place that their own government can't touch it.
But the story I had right before you came on, Ben, is that what do you use it for?
Well, that's another, you know, big question. So originally, the goal of Bitcoin was it become the future of currency. We would use it to pay for everything. That
make your house payment. Do
exactly.
This, do that.
People have not adopted Bitcoin as a form of currency, for one of the reasons being because the price is so volatile. It's gone from pennies to $20,000 a coin, then back to $2,000 a coin. Now it's at almost $9,000 a coin. How can you use that as currency if it's changing every day like that?
Right.
So nobody adopted it the way it was hoped to be adopted. So what Bitcoin changed into was a store of value like gold. So you buy Bitcoin and hold on to it. All these people hold on to it, hoping to make money. It became a speculative instrument rather than a form of currency.
Well, when you dump it, what do you get paid back with?
You can transfer it into cash.
Right.
That's what these exchanges are. So there's these exchanges now where you can buy and sell Bitcoin, buy and sell other types of cryptocurrency.
Well, why would they buy Bitcoin as a insurance hedge against cash and then convert it back to cash?
Well, when Bitcoin reaches a certain point, you start to think, well, now I've made a lot of money on my Bitcoin and cash is looking better and better. But let's be honest, right now, of course, the American dollar
is strong.
It's strong. You know, the United States is a very strong country and it's much, much safer. But that may not always be the case, and it certainly wasn't always the case. You know, so it's interesting to think about. At the moment, you know, you're safer having your money in cash, but you're certainly not making the kind of returns on cash that you would make in gold or in Bitcoin. So you have to make a decision what you want. Now, the thing about Bitcoin, though, is it could be a form of currency, and that's where it gets very intriguing. It could be a form of currency that would be way better than cash. Because think about this. You could send a dollar or a Bitcoin to someone in the middle of Africa if he has a phone instantly, just by texting it to him. There's no way you can do that with cash. You can do it through a bank. You can do it through some sort of a payment system. But I can directly send Bitcoin to someone anywhere in the world. So that's a utility that cash does not have. And, you know, people talk about Bitcoin as like the tulips, you know, the Dutch tulips. It's a bubble. But you couldn't send a tulip to someone in Africa in a second.
No.
So there is a utility to Bitcoin that does exist that's very intriguing. A form of currency that's not backed by any individual country, that doesn't rely on a country's military to keep it, you know, safe, that just relies on math, is interesting, you know. But the value of Bitcoin is entirely based on its demand. So the value of Bitcoin goes up and down based on how much.
It's pretty volatile, though, isn't it?
It's incredibly volatile right now. So right now, it's something people speculate on. But could it be used as a payment? Of course it could. And there are places that take it. You know, originally I talked about Silk Road. That was one of these places where you bought things on with Bitcoin. Now, unfortunately for the Bitcoin community, you were buying drugs or guns or things like that, which when we go mainstream isn't something that, you know, the Bitcoin world wants to talk about too much. But there are places you can still buy things in Bitcoin. There are ATM machines. There are Bitcoin ATM machines out there where you can put cash in and get Bitcoin out. And there are, you know, ways of using Bitcoin to purchase things on the internet right now. In the future, Bitcoin supposedly will be used to purchase other things. One of the first things ever bought with Bitcoin were two pizzas. This is a famous story where a guy basically went on the internet, and this is when Bitcoin was worth nothing. And he said, if anybody brings me two pizzas, I'll give you 10,000 Bitcoin. So somebody brought him two Papa John's pizzas, which he bought for 10,000 Bitcoin. And today, that would be worth almost $900 million.
Oh, my God.
So this guy,
is that a true story?
True story.
This guy, I would have ordered from Domino's for the guy and have it delivered.
This guy spent $900 million on two pizzas. And there's actually a website somewhere on the internet where you can watch the price of these two pizzas go up and down with the price of Bitcoin. So, you know, it's a weird story. And what's interesting about that is it tells you, yeah, you're right. If you use Bitcoin to buy things right now, it's a little crazy because the price of Bitcoin keeps going up, you know, or down in dramatic fashion. But the fact that you could buy something with Bitcoin is what's exciting about it. And so you look forward into the future and look 20 years into the future, we're not still going to be using cash in 20 years.
No.
I really don't believe we will.
It'll be all digital.
We
You'll have
everything with
card.
Our phones already, right?
Yeah. Everybody will have credit cards.
Right. Everyone will have some sort of online internet way of paying for everything. You'll have your phone or something like a watch, and you'll walk in and you'll scan it.
Or they'll try to chip us, Ben. They'll put chips on our hands.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the future. That's where we're moving. And
sign of the beast.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing, but the technology gets better and better, and things get smaller and smaller and smaller. You're going to get to a point where a chip is going to be microscopic, you know, and you're going to be walking around with your entire bank account on some sort of microscopic dot somewhere. And it will make the world more convenient, certainly, but the question then becomes, is it American dollars we're all paying with? What is it backed by, or is it something backed by math?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where crypto comes in. You know, the world has borders, and people tend to isolate themselves, but the future of the world is probably, hopefully, borderless or less borders, because we're becoming more and more of an international community. Certainly trade and buying and selling things is not something that any specific country is supposed to have all the control over. So right now, America, you know, is doing a great job, but 50 years from now, if things get worse, you're going to want a universal form of money.
Well, this is what I find ironic, too, because the Winklevosses claim that Zuckerberg took their idea and did Facebook, and then they jump into Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Facebook is talking about doing their own coin.
That's right. It just came out last week that Facebook is going to, you know, it intends to launch a cryptocurrency. The rumor was that Facebook was actually talking to the Winklevoss twins about how to do this because the twins are so far ahead of Zuckerberg at this point.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
So late, and even though they're mortal enemies, you know, these are the people you would go to get
it's all about business, isn't it?
Right. But, you know, the idea of Facebook doing a coin is a little terrifying because Facebook already dominates the world in terms of what we do all day long. If they actually had money, you know, they controlled the form of money that's out there, it would be a little terrifying, and that's something that may not happen because people don't want it to. But the truth is also, overnight, Facebook money would be probably more successful than any other form of money because they have billions of users, and if you could pay for something across the Facebook platform with a form of Facebook currency, you know, it could take over very quickly.
Facebook is huge right now.
Huge. Half the world is on Facebook.
I mean, they're making phone calls with Facebook now.
Mm-hmm.
You can see people talking to each other. People are going Facebook Live.
Right, live video.
I mean, it's just unbelievable what technology has done.
I mean, the world we live in today, you know, is lived almost, you know, half the time online. And Facebook is really the majority of the place we do that, between Facebook and Instagram.
You know what boggles my mind, Ben? The sending of pictures back and forth to people, your friends and people you care about and love. My granddaughter just had a baby shower yesterday, and she sent me a couple pictures of her and her girlfriends. And, I mean, they just show up on your phone.
Right.
I mean, through the ether of space, and they show up in seconds on your phone. That, to me, is the most amazing form of technology I've ever heard of.
It is, and that's a great thing, and that's something that's it's blended us together in a way that, you know, you could never have imagined in the past. And the idea of sort of the whole world as a village, no matter where you are, it's very compelling. And so those are the kind of the positives of what technology and social media have done, because that's what Facebook initially really was a way to just share with people all over the world who were your friends, who became your friends. You know, you liked them, you poked them. That's how you created a community. But then Facebook became something slightly different, because then all this data we were putting on there is valuable. And Facebook realized that to make enormous amounts of money, they can take all that data and these pictures you're sending to each other and these comments you're making to each other and farm it and find ways of packaging it and then selling it to advertisers who could then point ads directly at you based on the photos you sent and based on the instant messages you sent. Not the specifics of the photos, but the general data that's mined out of it. And that's where it got a lot scarier, because every time you put something onto Facebook, you're sending it to this massive company, this silo of information that then can use it in ways that you may not want them to use it.
That's a good point. And, of course, in terms of advertising, they follow you. But you know what? I don't know anybody, Ben, who has bought anything that they have seen on Facebook. Do you?
You're exactly right. And it's funny because sometimes when Facebook gets, you know, yelled at about what they're doing with data, they say, well, we're just trying to target ads. People want a better experience. Nobody's experience is better because an ad was targeted at them.
Yeah, yet they're making billions in ads.
Right. I mean, well, that's their method of making money. That's their financial system is these ads. But you're right. I don't know anybody who's ever bought anything on Facebook, but
no.
I'm sure there must be people doing it because the ads are...
They still crop up. Ben, stay with us. We're going to come back and we'll talk more. I want to get your take on UFOs because you wrote a book about that too. And we'll take phone calls next hour with Ben Mesrick as we talk about Bitcoin billionaires.